Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is glass artist and teacher Rhody Rovner. Rovner is a graduate of both Illinois State University at Normal, Illinois, and of Goddard College in Vermont. She began her career working in small glass studios and eventually founded the first teaching facility for public access in glass arts in 1990, which was affiliated with the Cedar Arts Center in Corning, New York. In 1994, she founded Hands-On Glass Studio, also in Corning, which offers instruction in glassmaking for adults and children of all ages and all levels of experience. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now tell us how you got interested in glass and glass arts and how you pursued that.
Well, I always say that it was by accident that I got involved with glass. I was visiting my brother, who was attending a small college in Vermont, Goddard College. Uh-huh. They had a small glass studio, and I went in the winter to visit, and I stood by the furnace to warm up, and then I never left. So I just stayed and continued studies there and graduated with an undergraduate degree in glass. And then I thought, well, now what do I do? So it was just a matter of sort of following the trail of glass where it leads.
Wow, that is really interesting. But were you in the arts before that? Did you always know you had an artistic bent going on?
I was always surrounded by it growing up because my mother's an artist, and so she did a lot of mediums from painting, oil painting, printmaking. So during my growing up childhood, I was always around artists and the arts, and that took us from San Francisco, the tail end of the 60s, so we were kind of in that whole, exploration, I guess I would say.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff going on culturally. Yeah.
And then we moved to New York City in the early 70s, and we were amongst the first tenants to live in Soho, which is now big and huge. But at the time, it was still just starting up, so it was the loft spaces were really raw space, and it was still considered illegal to live there because it wasn't zoned for living.
Oh, I love that.
It was still a commercial.
That's where artists are supposed to live.
So we kind of started in on that, you know, Soho scene at the very beginning of it. And so I kind of just grew up like that. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was normal. I didn't really think about it. I was kind of discouraged from going into the arts because everyone said you can't make a living at it. So that was the only, you know, downfall. But I still kept doing it. It just came along naturally. And one of the first things I actually studied after that was book arts. So I graduated high school and became an apprentice to a bookbinder who also started a program in New York City called Center for Book Arts, teaching facility for people who do book arts. And so I studied that, learned with him. And then by then, working as a waitress, living in New York City, you know, I was ready to kind of start exploring getting out of New York. And so again, that's when I would go visit my brother and when I just fell into glass. So then I just stuck with glass and started to follow the trail where it took me, which took me also to Illinois State University in Illinois. And it's Normal Bloomington where that school is located. So it was kind of, it felt funny because I was going from what felt like an abnormal kind of lifestyle to going back to normal Illinois.
Which it probably was indeed in more ways than one.
Tease me about that.
What was it about glass that attracted you, though? I mean, because it's sort of an abstract art. It's not something you can, like, pick up a pencil and know that you have a talent for writing or painting or drawing or something.
Yeah, I think because glass also is humbling when you work with it. To me, it was the most challenging thing I've tried to do. And it always has that movement and slight danger going on. So it kind of is something a little bit awesome to work with that material. And it's very challenging. I think you get engaged in the process of, you know, what it takes to work with it. And that's, I think, what sort of draws us all like moths to the flame. We kind of go in for that.
Yeah, and I've talked to other glass artists, and they talk about the magic of it.
Yeah.
How magical it is. No matter what, it's always different.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. And like you think, well, I'm so clever, or, you know, as you're gaining skill, I should be able to do this and that. And the glass always throws you a curveball, no matter how skilled, what level of mastership people achieve. They all feel they're humbled by working with the glass.
Yeah. So you were working in small glass shops, probably honing your art and working on utilitarian things and stuff like that. What made you decide to start a hands-on school in some ways in 1990?
I had traveled to Corning couple of times. There's a conference that many of us will attend called the Glass Art Society Conference, and it was held in Corning when I was still in school. So that was my first experience seeing Corning. And it's really a quaint little small town, but it has the history of glass, and it also has the Corning Museum of Glass, mm-hmm. which is for all of us who are enthusiasts or students or masters or whatever level with glass are drawn to the Corning Museum. So we all go there eventually. And so that's what brought me back after I graduated from college. I headed back east, and I went to Corning, and I went door to door. There were three independent glass studios at that time. Now there's one of those three left. Mm. And I went to door to door and asked if they needed help. And eventually I did get hired by one, and so that's what kind of kept me in Corning for a year, first year. Then another glass artist who's a Italian master, he had a small studio in New Jersey, Johnny Tosso. He asked me to come work for him. So I left Corning for another year, and I didn't know if I'd go back. But when I finished with him, I did go back to Corning. And that was the year, 1990, that I started to pursue the concept of the not-for-profit teaching program. It had been talked about for years, so it wasn't an idea that I just came up with on my own. I mean, it definitely been talked about by other people in Corning. Other people kind of got that ball rolling. But it wasn't really just didn't come to fruition for different reasons. And so then I just feel like I picked up the ball and just took it to see if it could happen, if we could make that happen.
God, it must have been so exciting to just start something like that, you know?
It was hard. It was a challenge. But we did it with, you know, a shoestring budget, and because at that time there was no money for it. I solicited donations and different things. So one of the ways I was able to facilitate it was by connecting to the local art center, which is 171 Cedar Art Center, and mm-hmm. their director at that time, Lois Welk, really dynamic director and artist. She's a dancer. So she really had an interest in seeing that the Art Center was affiliated with a glass program, since they didn't have really any connection with glass in that town. And so she, by connecting with them, I was able to use the not-for-profit status to then start seeking donations and write a grant, co-write a grant with Lois to get some startup money. And so that's how we just started. Again, very humble beginnings.
Yeah, but for to dare to start something so, like that in the epicenter of the glass world, where Corning Museum is, that sounds very brave to me. Did you work with them? Was there any kind of tension about you doing that?
I think everybody thought this was a natural.
It sounds like it to me.
It was like there should be a teaching studio. So I think everybody was on board. It was just, you know, the monies wasn't something that anyone sort of just came forward with, you know. So it was a matter of trying to use what we had very, you know, meagerly to stretch it out and to bring in money. So that way we, you know, started to try to be independent. That was the goal. And that takes a while. You know, we were on track to do it, and it would take a number of years to do it. But, you know, you just, again, whether you're a for-profit or not-for-profit, you still have to bring in money to support it. And so it was a matter of how do we do that. And I did it through the different programs. We had, you know, we had a summer program with a lot of week-long classes, weekend workshops, and throughout the year, also classes. And then the hands-on activities, which bring in someone who's a complete novice to have an experience, that also is a way to support that kind of a program.
How did you deal with novices coming in, especially children? Because it can be a dangerous craft, obviously. How you must have had very skilled people teaching some of these kids.
Well, we kind of set up a foolproof system that we could keep people safe while accomplishing, you know, to their satisfaction, the piece. And I actually tested on my own son when he was two, so he was my guinea pig. And it worked well. It worked perfectly well. So it's just a matter of setting up the, you know, what you're doing so that the participant is kept safe and it's a successful activity. So our Blow Your Own Ornament became one of those activities that we were able to do a round shape and also an egg shape, which we did around the Easter season. So, and making your own paperweight.
Oh, yeah.
And that lesson is a little more hands-on, so we say teenage and adult for that. But as young as 2 years old can blow their own ornament or pumpkin. So those are things that we've tailored to, you know, complete novice, all ages. And it's been successful, and knock on wood, we haven't had any problems with any, you know, people are safe during the whole process.
Oh, God, that's great to know, because it sounds like a little bit of a dangerous enterprise, especially for amateurs and especially for young ones.
That's a good point.
That must be so magic to watch kids' faces when they see these things being blown out of. It's a kind of a pipe thing, isn't it?
Yep, the blowpipe is a long metal hollow tube in a sense, and when they blow, people get really excited, and adults and children of all ages really find it interesting, and so it seems like a simple process, but their participation, they really feel like they did it. They were mm-hmm. part of it, and. And it is. It's exciting. And for us, working with the people, it always makes it rewarding when they get really enthusiastic and they get that wow, look and feeling of a satisfaction that they did it. They did it.
Yeah, yeah.
They made it.
To take us through some of the process, though, I mean, what do you need for just, say, a simple ornament? You obviously need the material that glass is made, which is partially sand, right? To tell us what the process is, the materials you need for something simple like that.
Yeah, I mean, the sand, as far as that being a part of glass, I always describe it like when you bake a cake, you have to have flour. All cakes have flour, but you can't just make a cake from flour. You have to have other ingredients, and those ingredients determine the type of cake, the texture, the color, the flavor for cake. But with glass, it's very similar. So we use a silica, which is a type of sand, and you don't just melt that by itself, because it takes extremely high temperatures to melt silica by itself. So the other ingredients, the other chemicals and ingredients added, create the type of glass, the melting quality, the working quality and melting temperature, so that you can determine color and workability with the other ingredients that you add to that to make the composition. But there is a lot that goes into melting and also to creating colored glasses.
Yeah.
So most of us in small studios purchase color. There's a couple companies in Germany that have been making them for a very long time, and we use color glasses that they produce because they're very consistent color, wide range of palette. And so the color that we use for our activities is called frit, and it just looks like crushed up colored glass. I always describe it like sprinkles on ice cream to get the color on.
Oh,
so whether we're applying it for the ornament or pumpkin, or the participant is applying it for their paperweight, it's a simple way to get color in glass, and it has a nice result to it.
Wow. It sounds exciting to me, because you never know exactly what's going to happen.
That's true.
That must be the exciting. And that would probably cause anxiety for some people. Some artists want to have total control over what's happening with their work.
Well, that's a good point. And it's one of the first things I tell people when they come, don't worry about the end result. So part of this is a learning experience. So because we try so hard to think we're in control, or we're going to make it do what we want, sometimes that is disappointing, because glass does throw you a curveball. Definitely humbles you.
it's like being in the sea. The sea owns us. We don't own it. Now, eventually you opened an actual teaching business, hands-on glass studio in Corning. Tell us how that segued from the nonprofit. And did it change in any way? Did you have different challenges?
Yep, that's a good question. When the not-for-profit closed originally, because we operated it about 3-4 years as a not-for-profit, developed the program, and then peers of mine were hired who visited from New York City, Bill Goodenrath and his wife, Amy, were hired to grow the concept. So what we started at a grassroots level grew also with Corning through the Corning Museum of Glass into their teaching studio, which is called The Studio. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary, and we're celebrating our 25th. So we started it. They grew from that. And then when the program closed originally, I took it on as a small business. I thought, well, I need to keep going. I have a child. I need to figure out something here. And so I basically took the same program that I developed as a not-for-profit, took it on as a for-profit, had just enough money to turn on the utilities and pay the first month rent, and then just went forward as a small business.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rhody Rovner. We're talking about her hands-on glass studio in Corning, New York, and her work as a glass artist and a glass teacher. Now, tell us what kinds of glass items you make. Are they utilitarian mainly? Do you do fine art in glass? Tell us what you personally do.
Well, one thing that I was told when I started the not-for-profit by many peers is they kind of discouraged me. They said, don't do it, because if you do, you're going to spend all your time, pour blood, sweat, and tears into running a not-for-profit. It takes a lot, and it's going to need a lot of your time and energy, and you won't have time to do your work, your artistic work. And they were right. The warnings were correct, but the reason I still did it anyways is that I feel like creating the program, creating a studio which offers the hands-on to the public, it's a part of being an artist, and it's a creation of making that space and mm-hmm. that interaction. So I didn't. I made it a conscious choice that I was saying, okay, well, I may not pursue my glass career as far as, you know, my own individual art, but creating the studio and making those connections is just equally important to me. So that's my art, is doing that. Uh-huh. And so what I make is basically, you know, things for the studio to keep afloat, whether it's the interaction with the public to do the hands-on or some products that we do have to sell. Just simple things. A range of things that I can say is like a pen holder for your pen, which uh-huh. is, you know, interesting visually, and paperweights, flowers, glass flowers, pumpkins, lots of pumpkins people are enthusiastic about. So, and then there's other artists that use the studio that also make their things. And we have a small retail area at the studio, so you can purchase some of the ready-made things we've made, ornaments, vases, and tumblers, drinking glasses. So a lot of different things that we have. Different artists have also contributed to our studio. But for me, mostly, I have just done whatever was needed. You know, there's one product that we make. It's a sun catcher, a glass sun catcher that has been used for running events, marathon. So it's been like a medallion sun catcher, which we can take a logo or artwork that someone else has, create that in a stamp, and stamp the glass.
Wow.
So to me, it's kind of like small art. It's a
art that people use every day and see every day, and it's yeah. it still sounds like a magic thing to me. So. You know what I want to ask you too, in regard to that, is there any way that a glass artist can copyright his or her work? I mean, all these are individual pieces, mm-hmm. right? They're all a little bit different. Yeah. Do you do that? Do you sign them? How does that work?
Well, people do sign their work, and when you get a little more established, where people recognize it as yours, you have your own style, you have something that distinguishes you. But that's always the goal, because a lot of what we do is, it's already been done. I mean, we think mm-hmm. we're clever and invented something. And then usually you'll look and either, you know, through history, a lot of Italian glass has covered so much that you almost can't feel as if you've really come up with something completely unique. There's going to be somewhere along the line you're going to go, wait a minute, I thought of that, and somebody already did it. So, yeah. you know, there's a lot of cross-pollination of ideas and inspiration. So, but as much as you can, our goal is to make it something unique that we can have identifiable as ours. But I think as long as you do that and realize that we're still standing on other shoulders. You know, usually there's someone else who's done something similar or thought
yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
So
it's like people who make instruments. You know, there is a formula, and there isn't that much variation that can happen now that the Renaissance is yeah. over in some ways. Right. And how much experimenting can you do, though? I mean, do you do experimenting with color and different formulas? Mostly
to try to come up with colors for the different products or to make your own items. Try to make new colors each year, so people who have done it before, because now we have had quite a following of families that have come through the years since the children were little, and now they're bigger, now they're starting to bring their own children, so there's kind of that nice really support and following from a lot of members of our community, and within 2-hour driving radius people come to
yeah.
us. But so we try to come up with something that's a little different, you know, and colors are definitely really, you know, such an important part of glass is color.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a great offering, though. You know, when you when I think about being a tourist and going someplace to do something that's educational and magic and just something that you want to make a tradition for your family.
Yeah,
it's really interesting to me because so many people just go to restaurants and go, you know, go to the zoo and they don't have anything to show for it. Their brains haven't learned anything. So it sounds really interesting to take art and turn it into part of somebody's vacation, you know?
Yeah. And I think because people feel, again, like they made it, it has that memorable experience. And it kind of connects the members of the family because we organize our schedule a little differently than the museum. We take one group at a time. You know, if we have a family group, it's just them, and we just concentrate on them till they get through all their items. And so it kind of, like, the groups themselves kind of socialize with one another. They watch one another. They laugh. Something goes awry. And so it makes it a fun experience for them that makes a memorable time for them as they come.
Now, has this era of new technology changed anything about glass making or glass producing? You know, I mean, like, digital has obviously changed photography greatly. And anything that has, or is it still the age-old, same formula, same
process? I think a lot of it is age-old. I mean, it's you know, the same tools. The things that would that technology would affect would be our control, you know, the controllers for keeping temperature ranges and safety equipment, things like that. But I think for the most part, the actual process of working with glass, it remains the same. It's very basic. And the tools and the processes are, I think, going to carry on through time. Just, you know, a little fancier equipment and technology to operate the equipment. Maybe even there are people that are trying some, you know, greener technology.
Ah.
And I had heard that there may be someone doing a furnace runoff solar. So that would be really interesting to find out how we can get ourselves off. You know, we're fossil fuel, you know, guzzlers, and we need to look at how we can break away from that. So I think it's a challenge for us with our, you know, what we want to do in terms of being conscientious people and then working in a medium that really uses a lot of utilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens when glass is recycled? Does it go back to its original form? How does that work? Do you know?
We can recycle what we use. And so what's already been melted is called cullet. So that's basically broken glass. That's what you shovel back into the furnace.
Mm.
The raw material is called batch, and that looks like a powder, like a white powder. So, but we do try to recycle the cullet, the once melted glass, to use that again. And then when it melts, it just looks like it's basically the, molten glass again, which the furnace itself runs 24 hours a day to keep the glass molten. And it's over 2,000 degrees, which is as hot lava. So that's, again, where we are the users of utility.
are you somebody who goes to museums and looks at some of the glass artwork? And are you interested in the whole medium in that way, too, the fine art aspect in real museums?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I can. Unfortunately, and it seems a little sad that I'm right in the, you know, here, the Mecca with the Courtney Museum. So I usually get over there when I have a visitor. And I think that happens to many of us in our hometown. We don't do these things until we have someone visit us, and then we take them there. So sometimes I don't get to see things right under my own nose because I'm nose to the grindstone.
Yeah, I find glass a fascinating medium, too. And it's so fragile. It would scare me as an art form.
Yeah.
I guess you can throw it down and say this didn't work and let it shatter, but otherwise it's something that you're trying not to have that happen to.
Right.
What would you say to a child who's coming through your studio who wants to be a glass artist? How would you guide them?
Well, there's different ways to work with glass, and one is the furnace working, which again I described a furnace, you know, running 24/7 and even the expense of that and having the technical ability to operate those, keep them running and repair and all that goes into that. So I actually sort of direct people toward another process of glassworking, which is called flame working. Hmm. And a lot of people do that. It's really has cutting edge now. A lot of people are doing the flame working and it's becoming more kind of broke ground a lot.
Well, what does that mean, so flame working?
You work with glass. There's two types. You can use what's called borosilica, which is Pyrex. If that's more thermal shock resistant, you can use that single, like tube or solid rod in a flame that's You can turn your flame on and off. So that's the nice thing about that utility is you just work with it in the flame. You can shape the glass. You can actually use the tubes to blow the glass. The other type of glass is called a soft glass, which has a little bit different working qualities. And a lot of bead makers use that, soft glass. But between those two types of glasses and the flame working, you can do a lot. I mean, people are really creative, and they're making amazing things from, you know, either vases and drinking glass, like a goblet you can actually make and blow on the torch, to some more decorative pieces.
Yeah, I've seen some beautiful vases in shops, yeah.
Paperweights that have a lot of detail. You can get a lot of detail with the flame working. I think a little bit more finer detail than we can with the furnace because of how you can position your flame and work in a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like glass blowing and glass making is a lost art, or is it an art that's holding its own? You know, I mean, factories make most of our glasses now. That didn't used to be the case. Most of the glass that we use for drinking, eating, and so on.
A lot of the factories are disappearing, from even Corning to Italy. They're not a lot left in the States or in Europe. A lot of things have become more mechanized for just utilitarian objects, and like you're describing. But I think the artist studios, the small individual artist studios, are still going to keep going because there's so much interest and a lot of people that are getting into it now. And it's I think that the small studio artists and small production studios will keep going.
Really?
But the bigger factories, I think, are on the decline.
Yeah, it feels like the whole culture is trying to go back to sort of like the ancient arts, if you will, or, you know, the early farming, or, you know. So glassmaking is part of that. I hope so.
Yeah.
I really hope so. Well, why do you think glasses continue to intrigue people through the ages? What do you think that is? Is it?
Well, it certainly has the beauty. You know, it captures you just visually. It's what it does. It sparkles. It glistens.
It mesmerizes.
Transmits light.
Yeah.
So I think that just the pure beauty of it is something that's always captivated people.
So it's an art that I don't think will ever go away. And I love the thought that it might be having a resurgence along with everybody else trying to go back to the basics in some ways.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I am so glad that the studio is thriving and people are still interested in the classes. Can you give us any information about upcoming classes, events coming up later in the summer, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, with us, we operate year-round, and people call to schedule, you know, by appointment. So we just welcome people to give us a call. And the website we have just shows basically what we have to offer, but we still direct people to call us, and that way we can talk to them about what we offer, pricing, directions to us, and be sure, you know, all those things for scheduling. We like to do it over the phone with people.
Yeah, well, give us the contact information, the phone number and the website.
Okay, the website is handsonglass.com.
And that's in Corning, New York?
Yep.
And the phone number?
The phone number, 607-962-3044. And don't be discouraged if you have to leave a message, because we do return our phone calls.
Well, great. Well, Rhody Rovner, thank you so much for joining us. This has been great talking to you about this. I'm so glad it's not a lost art. You are the founder and owner of Hands on Glass Studio in Corning, New York. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.